Hey friends, welcome to our next edition of what we're calling a virtual immersion. Since October the 7th, Global Immersion has been hosting a number of conversations that have been focused on giving us very unique vantage points on what's happening in Israel and Gaza, most notably in the perspectives of Israelis and Palestinians, friends and colleagues, peacemakers who are in the trenches of peacemaking from within the crisis and catastrophe that's happening over there. You can find all of that on our website or wherever you subscribe to your podcast, because all of those conversations are there. And every one of them offers some very unique pro-human framing and deepening of understanding, as well as some tips on how we can continue to engage this catastrophe as peacemakers. My name is Dr. Jer Swigert. I'm the executive director of Global Immersion, and I am delighted to have a couple of friends with me here in this particular conversation, Mercy Aiken and Dr. Bruce Fisk, who will introduce themselves in just a moment. This is a unique conversation for us in this virtual immersion series, because first of all, neither Mercy nor Bruce are Palestinian nor Israeli. They're U.S. American and they're Christians and they're peacemakers who have been in the trenches of waging peace in this particular crisis for a long time. There was a moment for all three of us where we began to become awakened to a larger story that we were unfamiliar with, a story about two peoples. And as we awakened to that story, we were confronted with some of the limitations, not only of our perspective, but of our theology. And not only of our theology, but of our ethic in the way that we actually showed up in the midst of this particular conflict. And you're going to hear a little bit of our stories, because that story of awakening is probably similar to what some of you all are going through right now, especially since October 7th, waking up to a larger story that's unfolding in the Middle East. The reason that we're doing this conversation just a little bit differently is because we are now 5 months and a few days into this crisis. And there have been a number of conversations that I've been in recently where it's dawned on me that attention is waning here in the West, that in the early days of this, there was a desire to get more information that actually expanded into a desire for transformation. There was a longing to invest in new ways toward a just and lasting peace, if nothing else, toward an immediate and comprehensive conclusion to this violence. But as is so typical in the world of violence and war and injustice, what captures our attention in the early days, over time, our attention span wanes and we begin to settle back into life as usual. Or we become overwhelmed with despair at just the scale of the injustice and the pain and the violence, and we become paralyzed thinking to ourselves, what can I do? What's one thing that I can do? How can I make a difference? And I don't think I can, so therefore I lean out. What we're recognizing in leaning in here for the last 5 months in particular is that with every person that leans out, lives are lost in the Gaza in particular and in Israel-Palestine more generally. With every lean in, the potential for lives being saved increases. And so everything that we've been doing here has been designed to deepen our lean in, grow our collective lean in for the sake of an immediate end to this violence and the chance for a just and lasting peace to occur. The second thing that really lies behind this particular conversation is actually in a conversation I had with my friends, Bruce and Mercy. We're a part of the leadership team of a network called the Network of Evangelicals for the Middle East. And we are working tirelessly to galvanize the support, the hearts, the imaginations, the resources of evangelicals to be pro-human as it relates to everything that's going on in the Middle East, to dismantle the strongholds of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia that run rampant in the church and the faith communities here in the West, and to really grow a pro-human understanding and response, a Jesus-centered response to the violence and the injustice in the Holy Land in particular. In one of those conversations just a couple of weeks ago, I heard all three of us articulate the struggle that we find right now of wrestling with despair that at times just feels overwhelming and paralyzing, with fear, because the cost of engaging in this particular conflict is very high at a personal and organizational level, and anger at ignorance and indifference, anger at the ways in which words are twisted to make the fight for a just and lasting peace seem impossible, if not irrelevant. there's anger, and anger is okay, but at times that anger tips over from righteous indignation into a dehumanizing rage. And when I was listening to my friends here talk about that, I'm like, that's the stuff that's happening for me as well. As I'm fighting like a peacemaker, these three realities, despair, fear, and anger, they cascade over me. And I'm recognizing that as a peacemaker, I've got to figure out how to avoid those things, because they will continue to cascade. They will continue to drench us so long as we're in the trenches of peacemaking. Instead, we have to figure out the tools that keep us anchored and propel us forward. As we wrestle with despair, we acknowledge the fear, and we name that sometimes our anger moves us into dehumanizing rage, actually causing us at times to become the very thing that we're fighting like a peacemaker against. So in the midst of that, I just invited my two friends, because we're working together here. I invited Mercy and Bruce to just normalize this conversation. We don't necessarily need more data points at this particular minute. There is a catastrophe unfolding, and it's actually in its darkest hour. What we need is to figure out how to move through despair, fear, and anger so that we can grow tough skin and soft hearts. We can increase our resilience, and we can engage in this until there is a just and lasting peace. And so that's the conversation we want to have with you. It's going to be vulnerable. It's going to be real. It's going to be messy, because we're human beings. But it's all designed to strengthen our lean in for the long term. And so Mercy and Bruce, thank you for joining us in this particular episode of our virtual immersion. And I just want to, Mercy, we'll start with you. Just introduce yourself really briefly. And if you can bring us a little bit more into the loop on NIMI, and then Bruce, and then we want to hear your guys' stories around how you began to awaken to this crisis in the first place. So go ahead, Mercy.
Wonderful. Thank you for that amazing introduction, Jer. That was really helpful. I mean, even as you were talking, I was feeling more grounded. Network of Evangelicals, or NIMI, as we like to call ourselves, we are a group of scholars and pastors and leaders and lay people who are working together to mobilize towards a more holistic perspective and engagement with Israel, Palestine, and the broader Middle East. And a big part of that is challenging shallow stereotypes about the Middle East that we hold towards the people there. And we want to network with the people who are over there. We want to amplify their voices and humanize them, as Jared has been saying, to the wider audience. And then we also want to invite evangelicals to come over to the Middle East in person if they can, and actually experience what's going on the ground. So I'm the relationship manager with NIMI. I've been working with NIMI for about 2 years now, but I spent many years living in Bethlehem before that.
Thanks, Mercy. Mercy and I have conspired together recently on a project. I did some writing and she did the visual front of the camera work on a curriculum project that NIMI is producing, and we're hopeful will be a good resource for the church on this very question. My name is Bruce Fisk. I'm actually the imposter or the interloper here, because I spent most of my academic career thinking of myself more as an educator than as an advocate. You know, I was really trying to develop programs, study abroad programs, bringing students to the Middle East. And I tried not to kind of make them in my image. I tried to instead expose students to as many voices as possible, Palestinian, both Christian and Muslim, Jewish, secular, religious. I did that for about 15 years with Westmont College in California. And 2018, stepped away from that, and now living in Peru with my Palestinian wife. So I do get some credit there, Jer.
You absolutely you get a lot of
we
credit.
We are still actively involved. We're involved here in Peru, and of course online, and we get over to the land as much as we can. So thanks for inviting me to the conversation.
Yeah. And a quick thing I just want to say here, even in listening to your introductions, is one of the things that we say all the time in Global Immersion as we're training peacemakers is that we all bring our unique fingerprint into this work. And we show up into the work of peacemaking with the tools that are already in our hands. And some of that is a pen. Some of us are academics. Some of us are activists. Some of us are political advocates. Some of us are artists. Some of us are pastors. And so, you know, for the sake of this conversation, I invite you to believe that you, in fact, are a peacemaker, because I actually am friends with people who both of you and your writing and your influence and your guidance has actually caused them to enter into the trenches of peacemaking, especially on this issue. So like it or not, I'm going to refer to you both as peacemakers, and you're doing it with unique tools, and we need all of them. there's a moment for all of us, I think, where we woke up to a larger story. And, you know, Global Immersion's primary work is to offer companionship to Western Christians on a journey from a pro-Israel theology that dominates to a pro-human faith that restores. Like, if we're going to actually form people into peacemakers in the rhythms of Jesus, we actually have to recognize that we've been socialized into a theology that endorses violence rather than a theology that actually lays violence down, including our own lives, for the sake of human flourishing. And so much of that journey for me began in 2011 in my last class during my MDiv at Fuller, where I went to Israel and Palestine for the first time as a part of a Just Peacemaking course. And at that point in my life, I was a relatively well-read and even globally traveled leader. And I have to admit that when I showed up on the ground in Israel, Palestine, I was blown away by how much I didn't know, to the point of being so radically disappointed. And I remember even asking myself, how is it possible that I know nothing about a more comprehensive story here? Either I am blind, or I've been fed a particular narrative and have never questioned it, much less stepped outside of it to consider a broader and bigger perspective. And so my awakening happened in 2011. And the journey for me, as is typical of so many evangelical Christians in the West, was to go from pro-Israel, because that's how I was socialized, to pro-Palestinian, which was really a deep sympathy with those who have been marginalized by the abuse of power, but actually believing that's not a helpful destination. So many of our Israeli and Palestinian colleagues say, don't go from pro-Israel to pro-Palestine. That might be a natural part of the journey, but the journey that we actually have to take is to pro-human. And so that's the journey that I've been on since 2011, and of course, pulled me and the work of Global Immersion into Israel-Palestine. We're not an Israel-Palestine activist organization. We're a peacemaking training and consulting organization that happens to intersect really intimately with that particular crisis, because it's intersected with our theology and our policy and our ethic. This isn't just a conflict that Global Immersion chose on the planet. We're intimately invested in this one, which is why we've been giving so much of our time and energy to it over the last 12 years. What about for you two? I'm just curious if you can share briefly like that. When did you awaken to this crisis, and how did it rattle your theology and ideology? Bruce, let's maybe start with you.
Sure, thanks. So yeah, I grew up in churches that I grew up in were default dispensationalist, default Christian Zionist. But we were polite Canadians. We didn't take it too seriously. We weren't too hardcore. I had my suspicions in high school and college and kind of read my way out of that and pushed away from that kind of theology, which includes within it a very strong pro-Israel orientation, an orientation that assumes that the events of 1948 and 67 are clearly God acts that, you know, foretell the quick return of Jesus and so on. And so we need to just get out of the way. This is the end times. All of that was something I kind of left behind, no pun intended, in my college years. It wasn't until I sort of had a real job in the early 2000s, working and teaching at Westmont College, that I got over to the land. So I was a late arrival, 2003, 2004. And like you, Jer, that was actually the tail end of the Second Intifada. And I went over there mostly to bolster my notes and PowerPoints for teaching New Testament and Bible, but very quickly saw that there was another whole world that I had been only slightly aware of. And so that started me on a quest. I kept going back year after year. So it wasn't sort of one moment. It was really a trajectory. And it followed the very same trajectory you just outlined, Jer, of going from default Israel as the righteous party to sort of the opposite. And then to finally realizing, no, that doesn't work either. This, you know, paradigm of binary thinking is precisely the problem. Not to say there's not asymmetry, not to say that there's not most of the power in one set of hands and maybe more responsibility in one set of hands. But I gradually realized that wouldn't be a helpful place to land. Some of the influences on me early on were actually Jewish people, like, for example, Jeff Halper, who is an anthropologist activist based in Jerusalem. He's like a teddy bear, Santa Claus badass. Like, he's just an amazing man. And I volunteered with his organization just to learn and followed him around. and watched him at work as a Jew, American Jew, who made Aliyah, and how gentle he was with his own people, and yet how clear his voice was. And so there were other people like that in my life that have helped me see, you know, see angles that maybe aren't obvious. And so when I brought students, it's always like helping them to see what they're already looking at, right? And helping them to understand that what they're looking at isn't what they think, but it's actually more complex. And there's some dynamics, there's some racial, ethnic, religious dynamics going on. Yeah, so it's been a long, slow journey for me. And I guess I'll just end by saying that the last 5 months have been another chapter in that journey. I've managed over the previous years to sort of constrain myself, keep that role as educator, do writing that was always sort of mild-mannered. I don't know if I can stay there. I think I've left some of that behind, and we'll talk more about sort of where we are today. Yep. But it feels like the last 5 months have pushed me into a new state of thinking. And it'd be interesting if I were still at Westmont leading student groups, how I would handle that. I don't know.
Right. You've cracked open the door to the conversation du jour. And so we're excited to dive into that with you. How about you, Mercy?
Yeah, I was very pro-Israel when I was young. I'm talking through most of my 20s, like my teens. I didn't really pay much attention to it when I was much younger, but like everyone else here, I grew up in a church setting. It was just the air we breathed. And I'm more from a charismatic kind of background. So I was around a lot of people who really had Israel sort of on this pedestal and really saw it through these very romantic glasses. And I'll admit, those glasses were mine too. I really saw Israel through this very romanticized lens. And when the second Intifada hit, I remember just being so devastated for the Israelis. I would follow the stories of the bus bombings and things, and I would just read them, the stories, and I would cry. And I never made any connection in my mind to Palestinians as human beings at all. Like I was a complete victim, you might say, of just the way the system is sort of set up.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't intellectually pushing back against any of it. It wasn't until somebody gave me a book called Blood Brothers by Elias Shakur in 2004 that I was first exposed to Palestinians as human beings with dignity and with wisdom and with this ancient history and with grace and with hospitality and kindness and all of these things that I had never seen before, because everything I read just presented them in such a dehumanized way. So that was such a mind blower for me. I read that book twice in a row, and then I thought, I've got to get over there someday. And then another 10 years passed. I'm just thinking how there's these 10-year chunks here, because then 2014, when Israel was bombing Gaza, I believe it was called Operation Protective Edge. And that became a turning point for me. And I just became really gripped by the issue. And there's a lot that went on that summer. All of it gripped me, and it just kind of turned me inside out and gripped me to such an extent that I actually like sold and gave away my possessions in North Carolina. I began saving up money, and I received support from my local church, and I went to Palestine to volunteer at Bethlehem Bible College, and I've never looked back. Here we are 10 years later.
So good. I mean, and for those of you who are familiar with Global Immersion, I just want to raise up a couple of things that I'm hearing here. When we talk about everyday peacemaking, there are four core practices: see, immerse, contend, restore. And to see is to pay attention to the humanity, the dignity, and the image of God, the pain and the plight of another, and to become more accurate in our understanding of another's belovedness, to actually see the world as it is rather than as it's been offered to us. And then the second practice, being immersed. Once we've seen, now we enter in, we step near, we get proximate. And in all three of our stories, that the noticing, the awakening, the beginning to see then caused us to immerse more deeply into the reality, into the unknown, into the wonder, into the even the chaos of this. And it's in the immersion that we found a bigger, better story, but we've also found the world as it is, which conflicts with the world as it was presented to us. And so for us, you know, for multiple years in different ways, we've found ourselves contending with Israelis and Palestinians toward a just and lasting peace. And it just so happens that the three of us and the work that we're doing with the Network of Evangelicals for the Middle East is to companion other Western Christians on that journey. And so it's amazing how three pilgrims on the way have lived some similar stories. And now we find ourselves collaborating together to actually bring some change to the fabric of Western Christianity as it relates to this. And thank you for your work in that regard. I want to get to the conversation on despair, fear, anger here in a second. There's one more question though I just want to put out in front of us, because, you know, this journey from unknowingly pro-Israel to willfully pro-Palestinian toward pro-human, sometimes that can be misunderstood as neutral, as soft, as convictionless, lacking teeth, if you will. And what I want to say first and foremost to those who maybe think that is the journey toward becoming pro-human, whether the issue that you're paying attention to is Israel-Palestine or the black-white race divide in our own country, or the struggle for liberation, especially among our migrant and refugee kin or our native kin, you know, in North America or elsewhere. To be pro-human does not mean that we're neutral. To be pro-human actually requires that we see the world as it is and understand that there are power differentials, that there's asymmetry, that there's oppressor and there's oppressed. The great challenge, I think, in being peacemakers is to ensure that in standing for the oppressed, we're not anti-oppressor. In other words, what does it mean to see the humanity, dignity, and image of God in both the oppressed and the oppressor? How do we become more accurate in our understanding of the ways in which we have contributed as oppressors for Israel-Palestine, this particular crisis? You know, and so I want to be very clear that to be pro-human does not mean that we're neutral, but it does mean that we're going to fight like peacemakers for the flourishing, for the humanity, the dignity, the justice for the oppressed. And we're going to speak truth to the oppressor. We're going to find ourselves in relationship with the oppressors to ensure that at one point we can all be sitting around a table together as co-creating equals, bringing to life the very dream for just and lasting peace that both of these people imagine. And so pro-human does not mean neutral. It means we're seeing the world as it is. We're speaking truth, the power and change to society while in relationships of solidarity with those who suffer. That's what this means. That work, as it relates to Israel-Palestine, is extremely costly. You go from, in my upbringing, my religious upbringing, you go from a Zionist Christianity, a pro-Israel Christianity, and if you defect from that in any way, it comes at high cost, especially from your communities of origin. And so I'm wondering, that happened for me, and I know that it's happened for you as well. I wonder if you can both just comment briefly on, like, what has this journey cost you? And despite that cost, why has it been worth your life? Mercy, you want to jump in on that?
Sure. Although I'm really curious what it cost you, Jer. Could you say real quickly? Because I would love to hear that part of your story.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, public humiliation, online shaming, loss of speaking and therefore economic opportunities, job opportunities that were compromised because I was on this journey to more pro-human on this issue. Relationships, close relationships with mentors, with friends and with colleagues. Book opportunities that didn't come to fruition, not to mention actually being in places where I began to absorb the violence of the state, both in terms of frontline protest movements and actually being a recipient of the pain, some of the pain, just a small part of it, but some of the pain that our Palestinian siblings have been suffering for over 75 years. You know, so it's like the humiliation, the loss of opportunities, if you will, the deplatforming, and then the actual physical absorption of pain for the sake of a more costly solidarity. All of that comes with the territory, at least in the story that I'm
living. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I resonate with a lot of that too. When I first began to speak about this issue, just on my own little platform on social media, I immediately began to experience that type of just pushback, accusations, false accusations. Another thing that it really cost me, I mean, beyond losing friendships, of which I have, losing church relationships, which I have, is just that I myself don't like controversy. Like, I am not wired that way. I'm not one of those kind of people who want to rush in and be on the cutting edge of wherever there's controversy. I'm an Enneagram 9 for anyone who knows about that. I hate fighting, but I have found that I've always been drawn to controversial things anyway. So I can only assume there is something of the spirit of God in me that is dragging me into it. But some of the things that has cost me, in addition to relationships, and probably some things that I'm not even aware of, but also just the cost for me of trying to learn how to be a peacemaker on the ground, coming to Israel and Palestine, feeling like these feelings of almost fear and frustration as I looked out from where I was living in Bethlehem towards the separation wall and seeing the soldiers there and feeling this antipathy in my heart and knowing that this isn't how the Lord feels. And then trying to navigate and hold like a spiritual equilibrium of love while engaging with this has been really hard. And I've made a lot of mistakes. And I feel like along the way, I have alienated Palestinian friends because I've reached too far to reach out to Israelis. And I've alienated Israeli friends by standing up for Palestinians at times in ways that they felt were offensive. You know, and so in addition to like everyone back home, there's also just navigating the struggles of living in that land and the learning curve of here I am, a genuine minority for the first time in my life, learning what that feels like in a majority culture where I don't speak the language, surrounded by another majority culture, which I do not speak the language, both of which are two different religions. And even the Christians I'm with have a different culture. And finding my spiritual equilibrium in that has been very difficult for me at times. But one of the things that has really just kept me going with this, because you ask what keeps us staying here, is I do believe the Lord has called me to this work, you know? So I just want to speak to anyone out there who's starting to engage and you feel like you don't know what you're doing or you feel like you're making mistakes. I just want to say, welcome to the club.
I don't think
there's any way to do this perfectly. You know, there is no I haven't seen anyone navigate any of this perfectly. We are frail humans with all of our own stuff trying, and we just have to keep trying and we have to keep engaging. Stay engaged with this, not only because I am deeply moved by the suffering of the Palestinians and the Israelis who are also held in bondage because of this situation. I'm deeply moved by this. And I'm deeply moved at how it impacts the wider region and our nation. But I'm also very deeply engaged with this because of how it impacts the church and how I feel when we talk about those shallow stereotypes and some of those things that Mimi is trying to deal with, the racist, theological racism and some of the biblical assumptions or cultural assumptions that we've had that in my view are very, very detrimental to the witness of Christ and the beauty of Christ. And so I care about the issue for that reason as well. I'll pass it on to Bruce now because I could go on and on.
Yeah, Mercy, that's brilliant because I think one thing that I would also add, because I know you and I think you and I share this, another piece that keeps us in it is relationships.
Yes.
The fact that this is not an issue that is somewhere over there. We are in intimate relationships of solidarity with Israelis and Palestinians who are saying, stay in the trenches with us, not as pro-Israel or pro-Palestinian, but as pro-human peacemakers.
Right.
Like if we're in the middle of the fray, absorbing all of the vitriol that comes with it, you should be too. Like stay in this with us, you know, and that's a critical invitation that we take seriously. Bruce, how about you, man? What's this cost you and why do you stay in the game?
Yeah, I'll try to be brief. A number of the things that have been mentioned, I could echo. In addition, you know, I think my reputation and standing at my institution where I taught for 20 years suffered. So in the academy, you have both non-Zionists and Christian Zionists. You also have Zionists who are not Christian Zionists, if that makes sense. But for a number of folk, I was too sympathetic to Palestine. I wasn't, you know, waving the flag enough. I wasn't critical enough of Islam. And, you know, so, I know at least one of my colleagues called me anti-Semitic behind my back. You know, when I left, there were no tears shed. So dealing with a little bit of hurt there, a little bit of professional pain, I'll be fine. You know, these kinds of prices that we pay are minuscule, right?
Yes.
On the ground, I like your emphasis, both of you, on relationship. And I've had warm, positive relationships, Jewish and Palestinian. I've also been wounded by some relationships that I think maybe expected a certain behavior or a certain kind of language that I didn't provide. You know, I've done some crazy things. I've inhaled quite a bit of tear gas. I went through one of the tunnels of Gaza a number of years ago, very dangerous stuff. So I was risking, I would say, maybe not paying too much of a price, but taking some risks to really try to understand as well as I could. You know, when you're rebuilding a house that's been demolished and there are soldiers nearby watching you, you know, one of my big fears or concerns was, oh, I'm not going to get to come back, you know, and they're going to keep me out. That's a minuscule fear, right?
Yeah.
If the worst thing that can happen to me is that I could get kicked out, I'll be fine. But those are some of the other costs.
And that's the reason I think this is an important conversation for all of us who are listening in is, again, to your point, Bruce, the costs that we've absorbed here are minuscule in terms of the trauma that is being inflicted on, I think, both Israelis and Palestinians by systems and power brokers who benefit from this violence.
Yes.
And so we're not trying to place ourselves on some kind of equal playing field in terms of, in terms of cost. The point just simply being, if you move in the direction of justice, it will cost you something. So to imagine that you can enter into solidarity with those who are suffering cost-free, it's irresponsible, I think, to think about it that way. Instead, if we can actually become the people that say, actually, there is a cost. I know there will be a cost. I'm not sure what the cost will be, but to absorb that cost is a part of my transformation. I think that might be a helpful disposition for us as peacemakers as we navigate this and other conflicts and crises around us. Now, the conversation around despair, fear, and anger, because Bruce, and you opened the door to this really beautifully. Since October the 7th, which as many of you know, I was on the ground waking up that day to the sounds of missiles and rockets colliding in the air above me, knowing based as I was watching the news in terms of why this was happening, knowing that whatever would follow was going to be a level of violence, the likes of which we probably haven't seen in this particular crisis before. And here we are now, 5 months and some change later. And it is being deemed by the ICJ as the kind of catastrophe that's being fueled by genocidal intent. So this is the scale of violence that's actually been unfolding now for 5 straight months, making this a different season for those of us who are peacemakers in the trenches on this particular issue, experiencing the waves of despair and fear and anger maybe differently than we have leading up until this moment. And so, Bruce, I do want to come to you on this because you opened the door in this conversation, but you also opened the door in the conversation that we had 3 weeks ago to just kind of acknowledge that. And I found it to be helpful because you created language for me in terms of what I'm experiencing, which I think is helpful for all of us to just simply be able to acknowledge that despair, fear, and anger, these things are going to come in waves and we actually need tools to navigate them rather than trying to avoid them. And so, talk to us a little bit around either all three of these or one in particular that is especially present to you. What does it feel like when you're navigating despair, fear, or anger? And what are you doing to remain anchored in it or trying and failing? But what are you trying to do with despair, fear, or anger right now?
Yeah, thanks. I'll start off and maybe stay with despair. And I certainly want to reiterate that I haven't fixed this or resolved it. You know, over the 20 years I've been following this part of the world, this morass, you know, I've seen Palestinians who lost hope. They've sort of settled into despair. I've seen a whole society that's just exhausted and doesn't have a whole lot of hope for a better future. But I thought that was just going to be the kind of the status quo. I expected there to be sort of this muddle of sort of melancholy, fatigue across the society. It seemed like Israel was managing the occupation quite well in that respect. And then comes October, and some of my Palestinian friends who have been predicting an explosion were proved correct. Yeah. So yeah, I'm tempted to despair on a couple of different levels. Let me just list them quickly. Yeah. I mean, first of all, maybe we're all despairing of our collective inhumanity, you know, how cheaply we value life on this planet, whether it's killing through bullets and bombs or deprivation. What are we up to now? 13,000 children killed in Gaza. And I heard in February that 82% of Israelis think Israel is using the right amount of force in Gaza. Yeah. So collective inhumanity, that can cut across all of the sectors of the world. And another one is the impunity, that despair of resolving, the lack of accountability with which Israel and the U.S. are conducting this genocidal campaign. Third, with my Palestinian friends, I sometimes am tempted to despair about the future, you know, how hard it is to envision a better future. I despair sometimes about the church and how it still often chooses the wrong path, and how an awful lot of my evangelical kinfolk are on that, what I deem to be the wrong path, that imagines God endorsing their violence. And then maybe selfishly, I despair at my own impotence. You know, I feel so often powerless to really bring about genuine change. And that can mean change in people's minds through writing and conversation, but also, you know, change on the ground. What has changed on the ground in Israel, Palestine, because of my 20 years of labor? I wish I could point to a lot of evidence. Let me quote from an October Sojourners interview with May Cannon, our dear friend. She concludes that interview in Sojourners like this. She says, "My mantra in the last year or two has been, despair is the luxury of the privileged. That is more true now than ever before. In these moments, we cannot despair. One of our obligations for those of us who are not in the middle of this is to hold on to hope and encouragement and solidarity in prayer and in advocacy." And I think that has been my mantra as well. Just like, no, Bruce, you don't have that option to give up all hope, to throw up your hands, to walk away. One musician says, that's choosing my temporary comfort over the greater good. And my lifelong troubadour musician, Bruce Coburn, would put it this way: nothing worth having comes without some kind of fight. Got to kick at the darkness till it bleeds daylight. So I've walked with that for a long time as well. We continue to kick against the darkness. Mm-hmm. I think I find despair looms largest when I'm involved nonstop in the cause. And so it's beyond me how people whose full-time job is fighting for human rights or for just peace, how they persevere. I don't know, Jer, how you do it. I don't know how May Cannon does it.
Yeah.
Let me stop there and we can maybe hear from Mercy.
Mercy, yeah, interact with that a little bit. I'm curious, especially how you resonate with May's sentiment on despair and that being an expression of privilege in what we do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when I first heard her say that, I felt like it kicked me in the butt.
No.
Because I was like, my tendency, like, I guess I'm an emotional person. I just wanted to curl up in a ball and cry for you know, it's like, I can't do that. I have to, there's too much that needs to be done. And so when October 7th, first, you know, the days and weeks immediately following up to October 7th was this feeling like there's no time to even grieve, you know, like hardly any time, because we're just mobilizing here and we're doing this, we're doing that, we're sharing here and sharing there. And for me, I can only go so long that way. Like, I have to stop at some point and curl up in a little ball and cry. But what May said, that, you know, okay, that is actually a privilege thing. People in Gaza can't really do that. You know, where are they going to do that? They're just trying to survive. Not that I have to put myself exactly in their situation. I don't, but I can empathize with it, sympathize with it. All of the, everything that Bruce said, I was just like, yes, yes.
Yeah.
For me, the past 5 months have just felt like, for me, the past 10 years just on steroids. You know, I've been grappling with these issues in a heavy, deep way from the moment I first went over there and began living there on the ground, breathing the tear gas, seeing people killed, seeing the hatred, the vitriol, seeing the, you know, the people who are doing beautiful, good works, just experiencing all of that. I have been navigating constantly between anger, despair, and apathy, not so much. Even when I want to curl up in a ball and cry, it's not because I'm feeling apathetic. Mm-hmm. It's just I need the emotional release of it, I think. Mm-hmm. But mostly for me, dealing just with frustration, mm-hmm. anger, most of that would be directed not even as much towards the worst of what I might see in Israeli or Palestinian society, but back in my own society,
yeah,
in my own culture. That's where I really struggle with feeling more of the anger and yeah. frustration mm-hmm. and the rage, as you as so eloquently said, the rage that can lead to dehumanization.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Which I want to hone in on that anger piece here, maybe to close out our conversation, a couple of thoughts. So before I do, one, I like how in May's statement, she actually raises up hope as the enemy of despair, you know, and now to suggest, and I want to be careful too, you know, around saying, if we experience despair, we should feel ashamed because are we just giving into privilege? No, if you're actually going to contend for peace and you're going to struggle for liberation alongside those who are suffering, you will feel despair. And that doesn't mean that you are, you know, some kind of elitist privileged schmuck. It's natural. But I think in those moments, we need to recognize that hope is the thing to grasp for in yep. those moments. Hope that violence and the darkness and the trauma actually is not going to get the last word, even though it feels like it's more powerful. It yeah. doesn't get the last word. And so for me, when I'm wrestling with moments of despair, because they come like waves, I think the posture of the privilege is to give into the despair and then render ourselves obsolete and DQ ourselves from the actual movement. No, don't do that. When I feel the experience of despair, there are two things that I'm looking for. Number one, I'm looking for some semblance of reminder around the transformation that is happening in me. Where am I now? And how am I viewing this now as opposed to where I was a month ago, a year ago in 2011, right? So holding on to like, I am in process, and that's helpful for me. I think more helpful though is looking for the mustard seed stories of light and hope breaking through the darkness of despair. So like, yeah, I remember this one public conversation that I was a part of where we were holding space for faith leaders in the West to ask questions imperfectly, which is a part of the fear thing. Like there are so many pastors who showed up into that conversation because they knew that the space would be held well for them. They wouldn't suffer because they used the wrong word or they asked a question poorly or whatever it is. And they came into that space under the shroud of darkness because they knew that if they asked these questions out loud, they would experience the violence and the vitriol from their elders and their congregations and their teams and things like this. So they came under the cover of dark into this off the grid, unrecorded conversation. And then one leader followed up with me and said, hey, can we talk more? And it was like a glimmer, because again, the work of global immersion, the work that we're doing collectively as NIMI is to move the needle with American Christians in the direction of a more pro-human understanding of what it means to follow Jesus. And it was a glimmer of hope to see one faith leader say, hey, there's something happening in me. Can we talk more? And that hour-long conversation, I think, was transformational for both of us. So in the despair, see where you've come. That's number one. And number two, look for the mustard seed stories where the light is breaking in. Bruce, what were you going to say?
I was just going to add a third. I love those two and it's inspiring me. One of my experiences this would have been a good 10 years ago. I was more than that, 12, 14 years ago. I was volunteering teaching in Nablus, which is one of the towns in the West Bank that tourists don't go to Nablus except for a church on the edge of town. And because this was really soon after the Second Intifada, there were still like young kids walking around with machine guns, you know, like basically fighters, militants or they would call them wanteds. And so we had to wear vests that identified us with this NGO that we were working for so that we wouldn't be suspect of being, you know, a spy or an informant. And the NGO was called Project Hope. And so that was what was written on the front and the back of our vest. And so the local people in the old town of Nablus, you know, would recognize us and see us as we wandered around, always with one of the staff. And one day I remember walking along and encountering an older man looking at my vest, and he read it. And then he just looked up at me and he said, "There is no hope." And then he walked away. And so my third component to yours might be that sometimes we maintain hope for others when others can't believe or can't hope for themselves. Maybe that's our job, to sort of be the one who carries them in the hope that we somehow find within ourselves and between ourselves on their behalf.
Well,
yeah.
There's a shirt that I love that says hope dealer, you know, like it's a self-proclaimed identity. We're hope dealers, you know, which is not pie in the sky, just detached from the reality of the pain. It's we're sober about the reality of the pain and the violence and hold on to hope and feed it and cultivate it within the darkness. Yeah, that's some of our work. Let's shift to anger here. We've got just a couple of minutes left. Anger, how have you experienced anger in these last 5 months? And what have you done with it? Help us think about this. Mercy, can we start with you?
Well, yeah, I deserve to be asked this since I really cited anger as one of my main things. Anger verging into almost where you have these very negative feelings towards the object of your anger, you know, dehumanizing feelings. And I'll just share a little story that I try to bring myself back to this a lot, which was a lesson that the Lord taught me very early on after I'd been there, well, maybe about a year. But that is, you cannot love your neighbor as yourself until you realize or understand at some level that your neighbor actually is yourself. And that was an epiphany that went just from my head into my heart, where I began to look at, you know, some soldier standing there at the checkpoint, think that could be me under some other circumstances. You know, if my family was Jewish and they moved over here when I was 2 years old, guess what? When I was 18, that might be me. And so then I began to think, instead of skulking past them, kind of feeling afraid of them, or just not really looking at them as human, looking at them through the eyes of my Palestinian friends. That's how I was seeing them. And instead, the Lord was like, look at that person like it's you. And so I bring myself back to that a lot when I'm dealing even with people that I'm angry with here in the United States. It could be me, and I have to love them as I would want to be loved if I were them, you know, in that place of ignorance or in that place of even just hardness of heart or stubbornness or whatever it may be. And it helps me to remember that Jesus walked through the land. When he walked through that land and lived in that land, it was very similar in some ways to what we're seeing today. And he navigated through that land, loving his neighbor as himself, because he could look into every single person, whoever they were, and know that he was actually going to fully identifying with them and would die for them on the cross. And so that to me is the main recalibration that helps continue to recenter my heart on my faith. And really, I have fallen in love with the gospel all over again, being in Israel-Palestine, because I've recognized it as a far more subversive, you know, way of living and being on this earth. And I'm not necessarily even looking for some big outcome. Like if I keep looking for a big outcome, I think I will be always disappointed. But the gospel often runs very counter to what we think should be happening. And it's very easy to say that when I'm sitting here in North America and not in Gaza.
Yeah.
But I have to hold to this truth that I believe where people are truly committed to living out the gospel in love, that is where change really will happen at the grassroots level. And where will it go? Only God knows. But we have to respond to him with our obedience.
Yeah. Bruce, weigh in here. Take a couple minutes as we're eating in our time. But what are you?
I'll be quick. So I mean, we're all angry at the politicians and power brokers. I think the three of us are angry at certain members of our own Christian community for the way they are so committed to a Zionist paradigm that they can't see the tragedy unfolding. And that angers me. I don't know if it should, but it does. And then I guess the one I'll just add to that is coming out of my background in biblical interpretation. I did my PhD in Jewish biblical interpretation. I get angry when I see the Bible weaponized and when the Bible gets interpreted in ways and justify, condone, bless, even celebrate this kind of violence, divinely mandated violence, apocalyptic violence that, you know, is part of some kind of biblical trajectory. And so when people start obeying the Bible, and this could be Jewish folk remembering Amalek, or this could be Christian Zionist folk, that enrages me, and I want to shout and scream. I take some of the advice that you've offered. For me, I think I need to just give myself breaks. I need to not take myself too seriously and not take my reactions too seriously. So long walks with my dogs, woodworking, poetry, music, reading, and staying in touch with friends. Those are some of the things that ground me. And yet their anger is still there. I mean, when I see one more story of a child that's been orphaned and lost his entire family, I don't know what else to call it, but rage. And that's a struggle.
Yeah. It's real. It's real, folks. And I think that I think we need to befriend it. I think anger is okay. It's when it tips over into dehumanizing rage that we have to be careful, because dehumanizing rage is enemy creating anger. And so for me, in those moments, I remember first and foremost that the people that I'm most angry with are the people, they're my people, and the ideology and theology that they espouse and they embody is the very theology that I was socialized into as well. So they are who I was. And that softens my certainty. It expands the reach of my empathy, because I'm not going to hate them in the direction of change, and I'm not going to scream at them in the direction of change. I'm going to love them in the direction of change. And so I need to figure out, what am I going to do to replace myself in a disposition of generosity with those with whom I adamantly disagree? How am I going to make sure that I can see the humanity, dignity, and image of God? I'm beloved and so are they. I'm in process and so are they. They're mantras that I'm moving through that keep me in the space of righteous indignation rather than dehumanizing rage. Why? Because if I tip over into here, I become that which I'm fighting like a peacemaker against. Yeah. And so friends, know that these things, despair and fear and anger, they will come like waves. They are inevitable on the journey of waging peace. Rather than giving into them and disqualifying yourself from the revolution, befriend them. Do what you need to do to let hope beat despair, to let love beat fear, and to hold on to our mandate of enemy love rather than enemy creating, enemy elimination, enemy hatred. Friends, thank you so much, Mercy and Bruce, for this conversation. It was real. It's what we needed in this moment. Onward, friends. Thick skin, soft hearts. Stick in the revolution for liberation and a just and lasting peace for the sake of so many. Thanks for being with us, friends.